Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Jacob Udy about his new book with Muggsy Bogues called Muggsy, My Life from a Kid in the Projects to the Godfather of Small Ball. Jake has written for many publications, including the Washington Post, Vanity Fair, and the Seattle Times. Jake, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming on. Jake and I have had a few technical difficulties I had to postpone due to illness. I'm so glad we're making this work.
Yes, illness. You must be the only person that's suffering from illness these days. It's not like a giant epidemic going on. No, thank you. No, thank you for having me. In all seriousness, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So, Jake, how did this project come about? How did you get connected with Muggsy on this idea?
Yeah, you know, I wish I had a more interesting story. It's sort of just things lined up. You know, I was talking to Triumph about a couple ideas. I live here in Seattle, Washington, and I'm a giant NBA fan and have been an NBA fan since my maybe early teens or even before that. And so I was talking to Triumph Books, the publisher of the Muggsy memoir, about a book about Seattle basketball, you know, with the hopes that the Sonics are coming back. You know, there's sort of this constant rumor that they're going to come back, and nothing was really working out at the time. And I was also speaking with Muggsy and his daughter, Brittany, who sort of does a lot of management stuff with him, about another interview idea. And that actually didn't pan out either, but I connected those two dots, and Triumph was interested, Muggsy was interested, and we just kind of got started. It was during the pandemic. I don't remember if we signed in late 2019 or early 2020, but the book was written while everybody was in lockdown, myself included, and just kind of plugged away at it. And I'm 39 years old, so the 90s are sort of right in my wheelhouse. I knew Muggsy's career well. I knew the Hornets well. I was one of the many people to have the starter jacket and to watch Muggsy
and Space Jam.
Man, they're everything. I was just a fan, you know. And it was a pleasure to dive into his career, and he's a one of one, and remains so. And I'm very lucky it worked out, and I'm very grateful that it did.
So I'm curious about the process of working with someone on an autobiography like that. How often did you and Muggsy speak? Was it like a few really long sessions, or did you speak regularly for, you know, once a week? How did that process work?
Yeah, it's different every time. And I'm actually working on a couple of projects right now where I'm speaking to the subject regularly, weekly, if not, I mean, you know, scheduled weekly, but then we have texts and other calls and stuff that are even more frequent. But with Muggsy, you know, we did a couple of big calls, and then I was sort of in constant communication over email and text and things like that to sort of check in about details. Or a big part of the book was him connecting me with people in his life, teammates and people he grew up with and things like that. So there was a lot of phone calls and texts regarding that. But in terms of the interview process and sort of the fact-finding process, we had a bunch of several big calls. And a lot of it was, you know, he has an autobiography or a biography or a memoir, however you want to call it, that came out in the mid-90s, so In the Land of Giants, that was a big resource. And also another book called The Boys of Dunbar, about his high school life with the most prolific or the most accomplished high school team out of Baltimore. So those were two big resources, and there's a lot of written about him. So I was piecing together a bunch of stuff that was already out there, and plus conversations with him and a lot of conversations with people in his life.
Got it. So, you know, obviously Muggs is best known as for being 5'3". He's the shortest player in NBA history. But you start off the book with clearly there were obstacles in his life and his childhood, you know, in addition to overcoming his lack of height. And it starts off in startling fashion with him getting shot at the age of 5. Can you talk about that incident a little bit and how maybe that incident specifically or just his surroundings in general shaped him?
Yeah. So to overcome being the shortest player by far ever in the history of the NBA, I can only imagine, or at least through the research I found out, that it takes a series of overcoming things through one's life to overcome that giant obstacle. And so Muggsy was he was used to overcoming things in his life, both a lot of ridicule because of his height, living in a city that was deteriorating around him. You know, in the book, he talks about Baltimore and the areas that he lived in Baltimore felt like a home, but almost with each passing day, people around him deteriorated with the drug epidemic and just poverty and, money leaving the city. And Baltimore is sort of notorious for not being great, as, you know, is depicted in the show The Wire, if you're familiar with that one at all, which is also basically about the time in which Muggsy was coming of age. Maybe he was a little bit before that. But so he was just constantly overcoming those things and doing so through self-belief. You know, I think that's kind of the only thing that you can lean on in order to do that is to believe in yourself. And his mother was very integral in that. His sister was very integral in that. And then his teammate and best friend, Reggie Williams, was also integral in that. And Reggie went on to play in the NBA and be drafted by, I think, the Clippers. And then he had good seasons with Denver. But I mean, from day one, you know, his life, his father went to jail, unfortunately, for, you know, not a big crime, but he was in there for about a decade or more. And so Muggsy just had to sort of deal with it, which is obviously way easier said than done and rather tragic. But from all those difficult circumstances, his resolve and his heart grew, and the muscles that he used sort of mentally and internally to achieve more than anyone ever could have expected. And as he continues to, those were developed and he had success in high school too, which is a major thing. And as a result of that success, his coach was given opportunities that then gave Muggsy more opportunities in sort of like five-star camps and things like that. And that's sort of detailed in the book too. But I don't think anybody can really know what it's like. I almost can't believe it, you know, and it's for those reasons why I sort of stump, if that's the word, for Muggsy to be in the Hall of Fame. Because of that just amazing resolve and ability to achieve. I don't understand it. You know, I wrote a book with him about it, but it's, I'm 6'2", and I didn't sniff the NBA. You know, Muggsy is a foot shorter than me, and he was in it for 14 years and averaged a double-double one of those years, and, you know, basically averaged 10 and 10 throughout his prime, 10 points, 10 assists, and he's amazing.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I know, you know, I'm thinking of guys who I'm obviously a huge basketball fan too, and I'm thinking of guys who now you could get away with being a little smaller now. You know, the game's gotten smaller actually than when you and I were kids. And for random name, Lou Bullock. I went to the University of Michigan, and Lou Bullock was there, and he was fantastic. But he was 6 feet, and ultimately it was believed he was too small for the NBA at 6 feet. And there are a lot of guys like that. And so to think at 5'3", it's just, I don't even know what you say about that.
Yeah. There's a history of some shorter people, like Isaiah Thomas, the Boston Celtics one player. He's 5'9", you know, which is six inches taller than Muggsy, which is significant. He was an MVP candidate. And everybody talks about Spud Webb, who was 5'7", which is also significantly taller than Muggsy, four inches. But yeah, I mean, the list isn't that long, and Muggsy, in a way, is, I guess IT, Isaiah Thomas, has accomplished. He was an MVP candidate, but Muggsy is kind of at the top of that list, especially as for someone to be as diminutive. And to constantly hear it, you know, everybody, every day he hears it. It's not that he would want to escape it, but, you know, people are constantly talking about something that should be a detriment to him all the time. and it's kind of water off a duck's back, or he's accepted it to a degree. And obviously he's had to, but it's just constantly remarkable everywhere you turn in terms of his resolve and his ability to just push forward and achieve.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something I wondered throughout the book, that here's this guy who, you know, as you just noted, you know, averaged basically a double-double in his prime, was a starting point guard for many years in the league, had a 14-year career, which is, I mean, remarkable. He played on a few very good teams. And yet, you know, when people mention Muggsy, it's, oh, that really short guy. Right. And there's some, and it's said with respect, like, wow, that short guy can play. But it's always kind of prefaced with that short guy. And I wonder, you know, does Muggsy ever feel like, I wish people would just remember me as a good point guard or a great point guard?
Yeah, though I wrote the book with him, I don't want to speak for him, you know, like as if I am inside of his brain. That's, you know, but I think he likes both. You know, I think he wants to be honored as an excellent player, which he was. And you know, some of the forewords with the book, especially with Alonzo Mourning, the first thing he talked to me about was Muggsy putting his arm around him, which is just an amazing picture. This sort of nearly 7 foot guy, you know. Under the wing of a 5'3" guy, which is just adorable and funny and just amazing. But I think it's dual pronged. You know, Muggsy should be remembered for who he is exactly, which is a standout player, a contributing player, an important player, and also someone who's achieved something that nobody else has even come close to, really. You know, Earl Boykins was 5'5", and Earl had a good career in a couple of seasons, I think, where he averaged double digit figures in terms of points, but. You know, Muggsy was an icon and remains so. I have a friend of mine named Earl Curitan, who was a teammate of Muggsy's on Charlotte, and they stayed in touch.
I know Earl. I actually spoke to Earl a few months ago for a project I'm working on.
Yeah, he's great. Great storyteller, and he's been around the league in a lot of different areas. And he talks about going to camps and speaking with, you know, young kids who are, I don't know, 13 years old now, and they all know who Muggsy Bogues is. And Muggsy hasn't played since 2000, 2001, you know, a few games in 2001 before his mother died, and he quit the league as a result. But the people still know who he is, and Space Jam helps that. And then, so I think it's worth remembering him both for his assist prowess and his lack of turnovers. I think he has the most games in NBA history with 10 plus assists and zero turnovers. And people have made the case that should be called a Muggsy. But he should also be remembered, you know, along with his talent as a player, what he achieved as an inspirational figure.
I'm glad you brought up the high school team because, of course, as you mentioned, there was a great book written about the Donzo high school team. And for those that don't know, Muggsy played with future NBA players Reggie Williams, who you mentioned, David Wingate, and the great Reggie Lewis. That would be a freaking incredible college team. To think that those guys were on the same high school team is flat out scary. And as you said, there's a case to be made. This is the greatest high school team ever.
They were undefeated 2 years in a row. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would we, and as you know, in the book, he initially started off at a different high school. If Muggsy had not transferred to Dunbar High School, would we have ever heard of Muggsy Bogues? Would there be a Muggsy Bogues in the NBA?
That's a great question. Yeah, there were some hijinks, which I'm sure is not unique to Muggsy's career, about one high school kind of losing his transcripts. And though he was a few blocks, like basically a stone's throw from Dunbar High School, he was bused to a place called Southern, and they wanted him to play, but he sort of refused to. Eventually, he played a few games and kind of just kept his wind up, as they say, and kept his career going. But he always wanted to be at Dunbar because that's where Reggie Williams, his best friend, was. And David Wingate, Reggie Lewis, who are sort of crosstown rival frenemies type of thing until they got together at Dunbar. But the coach, Bob Wade, was somebody that Muggsy knew forever because, you know, of his older connections and his family who were associated with Dunbar. He knew of Bob Wade. And Bob Wade is a former NFL player. And was just an amazing coach. And there's stories about them not having a weight room. So Bob Wade picked up basically bricks and rubble, you know, on the side of the street and turned that into basically weights and things like that for training for the team. But Muggsy had his heart, you know, his giant heart set on being at Dunbar. So if he was never allowed in, you know, perish the thought, he probably wouldn't have had the career because, like I mentioned before, it was through his success at Dunbar, but also his connection with Coach Wade, who was very successful at Dunbar and was asked to be a counselor or a coach at like the very, very famous like ABCD and five-star camps, which is before AAU stuff. That's where high school players went in the so 80s and 90s. And so Wade would pick Muggsy to be on his team, you know, when no one else would pick this 5'3 guy. There's a famous story where Muggsy and Scottie Pippen, another unknown person who is from, I think, Southern Arkansas, I forget the name of the college exactly, they were put on the same team together in one of these big camps and went undefeated. And that increased their draft stock immensely, immeasurably. And so had it not been for Dunbar and Coach Wade, you probably would never have heard of Muggsy Bogues. You know, I'm sure he would say he would have found his way, and you know, who am I to doubt him? But it would have been significantly more difficult if it was not for those institutions and for Coach Wade. So yeah, it's a great question.
Yeah, I want to say it was last year, earlier this year, I listened to a very good podcast on, it was like a 5-part thing on the history of five star, mm-hmm. and they kind of they singled out 3 individuals who really made their mark and came out of nowhere at high school, at five star. It was Moses Malone, Michael Jordan, and Muggsy Bogues.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And they told the story of Muggsy and it sounds like that was a pretty formative experience for him as far as, you know, national exposure and all that.
Yeah. Cause one of the themes of the book is always have at every level he was sort of allowed to, or, you know, brought in or introduced to, he kept having to prove himself, you know, even though he, you know, went from middle school to high school, no one believed he would be good. And then he was really good. And he went from high school to college. No one believed he would be good. And he was really good. College to NBA. And those camps are part of that, too. So he gets to these camps and no one wants to hang their hat on his skill. You know, they've heard the stories or they maybe see him shooting around or see how quick he is or whatever. But no one wants to place their own bet with him. So he constantly has to prove himself. And he did so again at the one of those camps. And that earned him a scholarship offer into the ACC at Wake Forest, which is where he went to school and was, you know, a star there and earned many accolades at Wake for his 4 years before entering the pros.
So let's talk about Wake Forest for a second. You described before kind of where Muggsy came from and what life was like in Baltimore at that time in the 1980s. And then he goes to this, you know, big ACC campus at Wake Forest. And well, talk about what was that transition like for him? Because a lot of people can't handle that kind of transition and end up going home.
Yeah. Which he wanted to, he talks about in the book, wanting to transfer, wanting to leave. He wanted to go to Virginia Tech, which is where Del Curry was playing. And I, you know, ironically him and Del became lifelong friends and remained so. And Steph Curry wrote one of the forewords to the book, and it was a testament to Muggsy's influence on Steph. And Steph was, Muggsy was Steph's favorite player as Steph was growing up in North Carolina and following the Hornets and all that stuff. But it was a culture shock. As you know, I went to college, I'm from New Jersey, and I went to college in the early 2000s, and it was a culture shock for me too. And I didn't grow up in, you know, inner city Baltimore, and Wake Forest is a Southern school. It's in North Carolina, but the campus isn't humongous. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of black faces. And I think there was a prejudice towards athletes and black athletes in particular, you know, that they only got in because of, you know, whatever. So I think all of that was difficult. And to, you know, on top of that, or maybe sort of connected to that, there was like some academic, you know, I don't know, I guess scandals. They weren't like national issues, but issues, you know, academic issues with Muggsy and people accusing him of cheating and or using, you know, tutors or whatever in improper ways, which were false, and he was eventually sort of exonerated. But that was a connected to the prejudice he faced. And again, it's, you know, I don't know why someone would put themselves in there. I guess he felt he had no choice, and on some level, he probably had no choice if he wanted to continue his career. But God, on top of going to practice every day and learning an offense and running an offense and dealing with primetime games and the ACC, you have to deal with that crap too. And, you know, it's a testament to him and you know, most people like him who are athletes that have to do that kind of stuff. And it's something I never had to experience and will never have to experience. And again, it's another hurdle that he had to deal with. So I think he liked Wake Forest. I think he honors Wake Forest. I think Wake Forest honors him today. But I think, you know, the initial entry into it was difficult, was jarring.
At what point did the NBA come on the radar for him? I mean, like when he was a young kid or when he was in high school, did he think that the NBA was a legitimate possibility for him, or how did that develop?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was always sort of in the back of his mind, but I think he was smart in that it was always what was important was the next level in front of him. So when he was in high school, I want to be in Division I college in a good school and a good conference, and that's why he chose ACC and Wake. And when he got to Wake, he was on the bench largely and put in for certain defensive situations or late game situations, and then grew his role there, and eventually was, you know, I think team MVP and ACC tournament MVP at one point. And towards the his junior and senior year, the NBA became more and more of a real thing. And when it was really solidified was when he played in international play. I think it was the Pan Am Games, and he played with top talent like David Robinson and other people like that, and against the best international players. And by the end of that tournament, he was, if not starting, was a very, very important person on the team, was on the court, you know, when the buzzer ticked off in a close game in the gold medal game, and I think was contesting the final shot, actually, against his opponent. And so that proved to him and to everybody that he absolutely belonged, and his draft stock just went up until he was the 12th pick with Washington.
And it's kind of strange what happened in Washington. I mean, he was there that one year, as you said, the 12th pick. I mean, a team, you know, has to think pretty highly of you to select you 12th overall. And usually teams will invest in the 12th overall pick, but yeah. it seemed they didn't really play him and then gave up on him after one year, really.
Yeah. The story of Muggsy's from what I've surmised and speaking with him and writing the book, people just didn't believe he could do anything his first few years. So again, it was, I made it to this new level, but no one here really believes me except for maybe the GM who picked me. And you could read the tea leaves a little bit, and there might've been some, you know, he was a local guy, so that he brought some cachet in that respect. But I think they probably wanted to sell a couple more tickets, having Muggsy Bogues, the shorter player, maybe, you know, connect with the kids, and that maybe the coach or some other assistant coach or something weren't on board with that. They wanted to win, and they didn't think they could win with Muggsy, who's also teammates with Manute Bol. So they had that very famous picture of the 7'7" Manute and the 5'3" Muggsy, and so there's probably some chicanery or something involved with that. But no one believed him, and he thought he could play. And by the time that first season was over, the team had made the playoffs, and he was the leader in assists, despite not having a lot of belief behind him from coaches like Wes Unseld and people like that, who's a legend in his own right. And so they told Muggsy that he was in their plans for the following year, but then they left him open for the expansion draft when Charlotte was coming into the league. Charlotte and
Miami,
right. And then Minnesota and another team was Orlando.
Orlando, yeah.
Next year, yeah. So, and Muggsy was picked third or something like that in the expansion draft. And Charlotte, he got to Charlotte, he thought it was going to be great. And then again, the coach there took a couple of years and a couple of different coaches for anyone to believe that he could produce on the court. And one of the coaches would, you know, he came into the Charlotte's owner's office on his knees and pretending to be Muggsy Bogues. Like, this is what it's like to guard Patrick Ewing, just kind of trying to clown him a little bit. And the owner himself, I think, was 5'5", which is not the tallest for, you know, a person, a man or whatever. And so he had sympathy and cared about Muggsy in a personal way, and eventually brought in coaches that would cater to his speed and his knack for dishing out assists and some things like that. And eventually the team sort of coalesced in part around Muggsy's skill set, which again is a testament to the value of perseverance. You know, I can't imagine the nights of doubt and the anger and all that stuff. You know, your first 4 years in the league, just kind of, not only are you not playing, but you're being disrespected by the people who are supposed to have your best interest in mind. And yet he maintained that legendary status, or grew into it eventually.
Yeah, and of course Charlotte became a great situation for him, it seems.
Yeah.
You know, as mm-hmm. you talk in the book, he had wonderful friendship with Del Curry, guys like Rex Chapman. Mm-hmm. It seems like he was close with, obviously, Alonzo wrote the forward, and Larry Johnson spoke very highly of him.
Mm-hmm.
And that team, I mean, I remember well, I was a kid. I mean, that team was on the rise. there was a period there because they had the back-to-back picks of Larry Johnson and Alonzo Mourning, and it looked like this is going to be the team of the future. You know, I think a lot, you know, Zoe is in the Hall of Fame, great player. I think a lot of people, you know, younger people really can't grasp how great Larry Johnson was. I mean, that guy was a beast. Yeah. I mean, he was, and then he hurt his back and he wasn't the same. But I wonder if, does Muggsy have any, you know, kind of what ifs with that team? Because they looked like this bright, shining star, and then very quickly it kind of all fell apart.
Yeah, there, you know, there was unfortunately some infighting, I think, between its two biggest stars. You know, Larry had gotten there first, had won the Rookie of the Year. Alonzo was probably a slightly better player. They both dealt with injuries, and they didn't have, you know, it was early, but they didn't have giant success in the playoffs. They won the first round in Alonzo's rookie year with a buzzer beater that he hit against the Celtics. Sadly, the playoff series where Reggie Lewis collapsed, and you know he passed away later that summer. And the team, but the team sort of lost in the first round leading up to that. And Kendall Gill was in and out, and he was sort of an important player that didn't, I don't know, see the vision, or maybe he wanted a bigger role on another team, thinking he was a potential star. And he's had some 20-point seasons, and it just didn't click, for lack of a better word. And you know, I think if I'm going to be candid, you know, I think it's hard to win in the playoffs with a point guard who's not super tall. Like, I think, you know, Chris Paul, who's a mentee of Muggsy, has shown that. You know, Chris has had some success, but as a shorter player, it's tough. You know, even John Stockton, who was the person who I loved growing up, a point guard I loved, who's about 6 feet. And while the Jazz got to the finals a couple of years, they couldn't get over the hump over a very long defensive-minded Chicago Bulls team. So I think that can be tough. And so then Muggsy got hurt, you know, halfway through his career. He had a big knee injury that cost him the season. And then Charlotte kind of scrambled and got different point guards in, Kenny Anderson included. And then Baron Davis came along. And I just think things didn't align in a way that maybe they could have if you know, Bill Simmons, the famous NBA person, like writer and all that stuff, if like, he talks about, like, if you could play a career 10 times over, you know, if you could play Charlotte Hornets' career 10 times over, they probably have more success. That was probably one of the weaker outcomes from what you might project. But so I think, you know, I think Muggsy's a realist, and I think he would say that they had a better shot, but also they did the best they could, and you know, think the chips sort of fell where they went. It was a weird time for the NBA too, because money, people were getting big deals, and LJ got a giant deal. I think Alonzo wanted a giant deal. I don't know, you know, if the team, a small market team, could afford both of them, even though the salary cap wasn't the same. It was just a weird time in the league in the 90s. You know, the attention was exploding, and you see people like Scottie Pippen and even Michael Jordan, they signed long-term contracts that hurt them in the long run. But I just think it was a difficult time. You know, it was post-80s with Magic and Larry, and the Bulls hadn't super solidified themselves yet. It was just an awkward time for the league, and I think the Hornets kind of suffered from that.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I want to go back to that first year in Washington for a second, because you know, I enjoyed reading, and you talk to guys from that generation or even older players, and inevitably, as Muggsy did, they talk about the guys who helped them when they got to the league, the veteran presence. And I think that's something that's missing from the league now. I think we there's so much emphasis on youth and developing youth, and and we don't have enough of those guys. You know, Taj Gibson was on the Knicks for the last couple of years. I'm a Knicks fan. Like he was great. I mean, he could still play a little bit, but he brought so much value to the locker room as just a leader and a mentor, and somebody who could tell you, hey, this is how you take care of your money. This is how you dress. This is how you keep your body right. You know, all that stuff. And it was kind of cool to hear Muggsy in the book talk about some of those guys who really helped him out. And, you know, and it was, you know, for most guys, it's difficult your rookie season, but can you talk about some of those guys that helped him along the way?
Yeah. The person that jumps out to me and jumped out to me in the story was Moses Malone. He just seems like a constant mentor for people. There's that famous story where he told Charles Barkley that Charles had to lose 50 pounds in order to stay in the league. But Moses was important to Muggsy, and so was Manute Bol. You know, they had conversations. Manute was in the USBL, which is like a developmental league, before he made it to the NBA, and Muggsy spent some time there too. And so they had that in common. And even in the USBL, there were other players that sort of helped Muggsy believe that he belonged and said that he could play and all those things. And then, you know, famously, Muggsy flipped that around and became that person on teams like Golden State and Toronto. And that's what he was brought in to sort of be a mentor to people like Vince Carter and Tracy McGrady and things like that. And that's actually, kind of a bigger part of the book, is talking about his relationships with people like that and how important that he, you know, Steph Curry included, even though they weren't ever teammates. So I think Muggsy appreciated the mentorship and then knew how valuable it was to sort of flip it around. And I was listening to an interview or a podcast, something like today. It was Brian Windhorst on like the Hoop Collective or something like that. And one of the guests was talking about Damian Lillard and how Mo Williams was important to Damian on Portland and how now Damian's transferring that to Anthony Simons. And so that is important. And I think the people who have, you know, their hearts in the right place know how important that can be. And Muggsy, like, man, he's at the center of it. It's all the people that came out, you know, getting calls from Charles Oakley and Vince Carter and Rex Chapman. I mean, Rex Chapman would still be talking about Muggsy if he could. You know, Earl Cureton, all these people that Muggsy had an influence on. And that was just like kind of the biggest part of the book to me. I mean, I don't, Steph Curry doesn't do a whole lot of, he's like the fifth most famous person in the world, but he stopped his day to do a forward for Muggsy. And that's a testament to sort of, you know, the leadership and the hand that Muggsy had in so many people's careers. Alonzo too. But in terms of Muggsy's early career, you know, Moses Malone was a big important person. Development. Yeah.
You mentioned before, I want to go back to it. You know, Reggie Lewis's tragic death. How did that affect Muggsy?
Oh man, devastating. He talks about in the book when he found out, he just, you know, dropped the phone and was crying and in disbelief. It wasn't just someone he knew and loved, you know, this is someone that Muggsy was something of a mentor to. Reggie was from Baltimore, and they're about the same age. I can't remember up top. They were the same class, but Reggie sort of, he was the sixth man on Dunbar. He wasn't even a starter. That's how good the team was. And he sort of took a long time to develop. You know, he went to Northeastern, which isn't the biggest school in the world, and eventually was drafted by the Celtics and became, you know, potentially Michael Jordan's biggest rival before Reggie died, unfortunately. And he was an all-star and the Boston Celtics captain. So Muggsy got to see him really grow into his role. And to be in the playoff series where he sees him fall, and I think there's some amount of disbelief where you're like, okay, it's got to be an ankle. It's got to be, you know, his thigh hurts or something. Like, but even though Reggie wasn't touched when he fell, nothing caused him to fall. It was his heart, of course. And then, you know, I'm sure there was some amount of like, I wish I could have done more. I think everybody thought that, you know, Reggie died shooting around alone in a gym, you know, in the summer between that playoff series and the next year. And Muggsy talks in the book about playing a preseason game that following year in the fall against Boston. And that's when it really hit him, because Reggie was supposed to be there and he wasn't. So, you know, a friend died, an important NBA figure died. It was a big loss, you know, in terms of his family, his friendship, and his like professional circle. And I didn't ask him this, and maybe I should have, but there's probably a sense that everybody wishes they could have done more for him. Just told him to stop playing, you know, rest your heart, learn your heart, figure out what's wrong. And that, of course, there's that famous doctor who did all, you know, bent over backwards to say it wasn't Reggie's heart, while everybody else in the medical community and basketball community were basically saying it was. And so it's tragic. It's you know, one of the more tragic things that's ever happened in the NBA. And to have it be your best friend is just devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. How did it feel for Muggsy to get traded?
He did not like it to get traded. I mean, I think Charlotte was home. I think he had visions of eventually ending his career there and, you know, working his way up to the front office and just sort of being one of the Charlotte Hornets for life. But management and one of his coaches, I forget the guy, his name off the top of my head, you know, suggested he should retire. And Muggsy thought he had plenty of years left, which he proved he did. And so Golden State, which was one of the worst teams in the league and very much rebuilding, wanted to bring in that veteran presence that you talked about to mentor its, you know, younger players like Antoine Jameson and folks like that. And so they brought in Muggsy, they traded for him, and he was welcomed and he was appreciative for that. But I think it sucks to be dealt from your home, you know, and not want, you know, not feeling as if you're not welcomed in the place that you basically built. I mean, he was there from day one, one of the first selections on the team, along with Del Curry and Rex Chapman. You know, but he's good at building a home and making relationships, and so he was cool in Golden State, and then he eventually got the opportunity to go to Toronto with joining back up with Dell, which I think was a big major, you know, influence in him going to the Raptors and that expansion team and dealing again with younger players like Vince and Tracy and things like that. But it hurt, you know. It was definitely a point for him that it hurt, and it took some years to rectify. And he's back with the Hornets now. He's an ambassador there and works with the team, and he's on TV and here and there. And he did a book signing at the stadium, and he works with the front office and has a relationship, I think, with Michael Jordan, which is his own thing. But it took some years to rectify, and it hurt to be expelled in some way. Yeah.
Yeah. as you mentioned, you went to Toronto, and Toronto, that was a fun team. It was interesting. Amazing because, you know, Muggsy, I guess maybe it's inevitable when you play in the league for 14 years, but I mean, he played with a lot of great players, and, you know, he started his career with Moses Malone and finished it with Vince Carter and Tracy McGrady. I mean, that's incredible.
That's a pretty big span. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But it was cool because it seems like it was a nice situation for him in that it wasn't just the young guys and him. It, you know, Oakley was there, and his close friend Del Curry was there, and I think Antonio Davis was there. Like, they had other – it was a good mix of young guys and vets. How did he – once he kind of settled in there, did he enjoy his time in Toronto?
Yeah, it was great. He signed there for the minimum in 2000, wanting to prove himself. You know, the Golden State situation was tough. He was shooting around with Sprewell when the whole Sprewell PJ Carlissimo thing happened. He was, again, he's sort of like the Forrest Gump of the NBA, and I say that lovingly. Right. That he was like part of everything, including that. And so his career was in flux. Leaving Golden State was weird. That whole situation was weird. They didn't win very many games. So he signed for the minimum to prove himself in Toronto and did so. He was a contributor and played well. I think in one of the playoff games, he had double-digit points. And they ended up signing him to, I believe, a four-year deal after that for the beginning in the 2001 season. But then his mom died, and he was so, so close with his mom in the minute that she passed away, he dropped everything and left the league, and you know, wanted her to see his final game, and so he had this contract, which was eventually traded a couple of times, I think, to the Knicks and to Dallas, and I think Mark Cuban, they like dissolved the contract but paid him all the money, things like that. So he did solidify himself in Toronto and would have played 4 years there had there not been like a family tragedy. Vince speaks very highly of him. There's great, you know, YouTube videos of alley-oops and things like that. And Tracy was important, although Tracy eventually went to Orlando, famously. But Yeah, Muggsy was like an assistant coach and a friend and a big brother and a valuable contributor in limited minutes with the Raptors. So I think it was like kind of, and you know, it was an expansion team or basically an expansion team. So it had some, it mirrored Charlotte a little bit, and he was big with the kids there as he always is. So it was just a win-win situation. And sadly his mother passed away, and that, you know, forced him in his own mind to leave the league. And so he probably could have played, you know, he played 14 years. He probably could have played 16 or more. Yeah.
Yeah. So after his career, I lost my train of thought there for a second.
Yeah.
After his career, he coached for a few years, and he talks in the book. It sounds like that was a very positive experience for him. Does he have any interest in getting back into coaching?
You know, I don't know. If the answer would be yes, it would be, you know, based on the right situation. He's approaching 60. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know what he wants to do in terms of like the, you know, the sort of final chapters or whatever in his life. He's working as an ambassador with the Hornets, and I think he finds a lot of satisfaction there. He's got a family. He's got kids. He works with his daughter. He's got a grandson who's an up-and-coming basketball player, and that's sort of where we end the book talking about, because his grandson is very skilled but also very short. And when Muggsy's daughter, a different daughter than the one he works with closely, different than Brittany, when she talked about her son, it was so beautiful to me because she said that people don't call him short. They just say he plays like Muggsy, which I think is just a testament to a life well lived, in that Muggsy's work and dedication paid off, that people aren't ridiculed for being short. They now have, you know, their person that they're compared to. It's like, you're not short, you play like Muggsy. It's a different, the conversation's bent in a different direction thanks to the, you know, his determination. And so I just thought that was a great way to end the book. But yeah, you know, I think he's pretty comfortable. He's in commercials for like Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and he was part of their the NBA's 75th year commercials doing stuff. He's a legend. He's a one of one. He's memorable for a very distinct reason, something that no one else has ever really come close to. And I think it's pretty good to be Muggsy Bogues right now. You know, if he was offered a coaching job or an assistant job, I don't know if he would take it. I'm sure he would consider it. But I think it would take a lot to switch up, you know, kind of what he's doing these days.
There's a great story in the book, and I can't remember who it was now, but one of his teammates didn't know his real name.
Yeah.
And, you know, here we're having this conversation, and it's Muggsy, 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 and that's what he goes by. Is there anyone in his life who calls him Tyrone?
I don't think so. No, maybe his mom was the last person to do that. And he didn't even like his nickname at first because he didn't want to be associated with theft, I think, with this idea of mugging people.
Right.
But, you know, when you're 5'3" and you steal the ball all the time and you got a great big smile and, you know, people call you Muggsy, which is also the name of a television character of a show that he liked, I think it sticks. And he had no choice on some level, so he kind of embraced it. And what a great name, Muggsy, you know, yeah. Muggsy Bogues. It's like you can picture him without even knowing what he looks like.
I kind of said before, I thought, you know, I thought this as I was reading the book that it seems to me like Muggsy would, I don't, you know, he had a great career as it was, but it seems like he would fit even better in today's game, you know, with the kind of the pace and space, pushing the ball up the floor. The game's not as physical. He'd have more, you know, it's more pick and roll. He'd have more room to get yeah. the lane, get to the basket, you know, distribute for others. Is that something you've talked about with him? How he would.
Yeah, he always sort of famously says that every NBA player thinks they could play at any level or any generation. And Muggsy could score. You know, he had a good shot. He was always a good free throw shooter, which is an indication of a good shooter in general for the most part. He just didn't look for it all the time. You know, it was a way to keep defenses honest, not a way to pad stats. So he was always looking to pass. But I think in a league, in an era that involves shooting, he would not have hurt any of the teams that he was on. And, you know, Michael Jordan famously, and I don't know, he averaged 20% from three, you know, some years of his career, but he wasn't practicing. It wasn't a focal point. So I think if Muggsy was coming up today in a league influenced by Steph Curry, who was influenced by Muggsy Bogues, I think he would be just fine. You know, defense is always the issue in terms of when it gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And so he would have had to have been in a team that could, you know, do well with that. He may have been, you know, he's obviously an excellent defender and could steal the ball, and was, and no one wanted to bring it up against him. He was 94 feet, all those things. But in a half court setting, I think that's the one thing, if he had a flaw, to play half court defense in crunch time in the playoffs, that's something that maybe would have had to be, have been figured out a little bit better than Charlotte figured out. But, you know, if he's playing on teams with Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan, I think he would have been fine. You know, people with long arms, good, excellent defenders. And he was obviously an excellent defender in and of himself, in his own right, you know, and people like Steve Nash did well, although Nash was obviously a little bit taller, but you know, if you have Sean Marion and other people like that on your team, it can help. But, so that's the one area, if we're going to be sort of all-encompassing and a little bit critical, that's the one area where Muggsy maybe wasn't, you know, an all-world person. But to be good at nine things and not great at the 10th, you know, that'll indicate an excellent career, which is what he had.
Yeah. And along those lines, you said it before, and then you talk in the introduction of the book, that you believe he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah.
So Jake Udy, this is your platform. I'm Jerry Colangelo, and who the nominating committee, however the heck that works. Give me your pitch for Muggsy Bogues to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've said it a couple of times, but he's a one of one. You know, let's say there's 500 people in the Hall of Fame. Does your average NBA fan know 450 of them? Maybe not, but they definitely know Muggsy Bogues. The consistent impact that he has on fans and as a point of inspiration, you know, maybe the coolest thing maybe in the whole book was Steph Curry talking about he just wanted to be 5'3" at some point in his life because he knew then he had a chance, and Muggsy gave that to people. I'm not sure that there's a bigger gift that any player is given to any young kid than to give that benchmark of, no, I don't have to be 6 feet. I don't have to be 6'5". If I could just be 5'3", you know, every fifth grader is thinking about that. If I can just be 5'3", I have a chance. And Muggsy Bogues gave that to the world. And, you know, the Hall of Fame is dependent upon, you know, MVPs, All-Stars, XYZ, and maybe it shouldn't be. You know, I heard Jeff Van Gundy in the great podcast with Zach Lowe talk about, you know, maybe people like Charles Oakley should be in the Hall of Fame. You know, Charles probably averaged a double-double a couple times in his career, but he was so impactful and so memorable. How do you quantify that? And you know, even if you can't in statistics, shouldn't that be honored in some sort of historic way? And I mean, we're talking about Muggsy Bogues. He hasn't played for 20 years. You and I both have a fondness for him, know him. I've thought about him throughout our lives as NBA fans. Like, there's other criteria other than how many times you were not on an All-Star team. And so that's what I would say.
Absolutely. And, you know, another guy that comes to mind who's been talked about, when Rudy Tomjanovich got in the Hall of Fame, he kind of stumped for Robert Horry.
Right. Exactly. Another perfect example like that.
The other thing is, you know, there's you get in the Hall of Fame as a player and a coach. You could also get in as a contributor.
Right.
So how do we define that?
Yeah.
That might be his strongest case, right? His contribution to the growth and the popularity of the game and a lot of things that you touched on, the belief that he's given to smaller players and just the way he's changed the perception of what it is to be a basketball player. That might be the best avenue for him, but
yeah,
it's an interesting argument.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's tough. You know, sports is great because it's quantifiable. And I think contributions that Muggsy has made and people like him aren't as easily numerically quantifiable. But I think, you know, one number is just the amount of kids that light up when they think of him or see him or, you know, Space Jam, things like that. And again, to give I remember being in fifth grade and I was 5 feet tall and thinking, I just want to get to 5'3". I shared that same moment that Steph Curry talked about. And now I didn't have the impact of Steph Curry, of course, a few have, but you know, that we both shared that hope or that, you know, that sort of benchmark. That's a gift Muggsy Bogues gave us and has given millions, tens of millions of people, continues to give tens of millions. I mean, everybody who plays basketball Googles nowadays who's the shortest player.
Yeah.
It's just you can't get past that. And Muggsy Bogues pops up and I don't know. That seems like a pretty big contribution.
Well, and I would add this, that everybody who saw him play, and as you know, many people since, both liked him and respected him. Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody, universally, right?
Yeah.
Teammates, opponents, fans, everybody liked him and respected him. And you can't say that about too many people.
And Earl, who we talked about, Earl Cureton, he played with Dr. J, played with Michael Jordan, played with Isaiah Thomas, played with Moses Malone, and he says that Muggsy's the greatest athlete he's ever played with or been around.
Right.
So there's that. Yeah. You can leave it there.
All right, Jake, I'm going to get you out of here with one last question that I like to ask all my guests. First, once again, the name of Jake's book is Muggsy, My Life from Akin the Projects to the Godfather of Small Ball. I hope you could tell from my tone throughout this interview that I love the book.
Thank you.
I'm a fan of Muggsy. It was very well told, and we didn't get a lot into it, kind of more of his personal stuff, his relationship with his brother. And he's a beautiful family man.
Yeah.
With his children, his mother, his brother, his late sister.
The story with his wife is incredible. Also
remarkable. Yeah. But it's a great book. He's just a wonderful subject, and he and Jake did a great job with it. Definitely check it out. So, Jake, my final question for you is, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
Oh, man. The first one that just jumped into my brain is Friday Night Lights. I thought that book was incredible. I couldn't put it down. The story of high school football in Texas. I've been reading tons of them lately. I just read the Scottie Pippen biography by Michael Arcouche. I hope I'm saying that right. Who's a very brilliant, very sweet person. The Ray Allen also by the Ray Allen one also by Michael. Brian Windhorst has written great books about LeBron James. Man, there's the first one I ever read was Drive, the Larry Bird one. This was like when I was in middle school. The first one that jumps out is Friday Night Lights. But there's so many. I just read this giant 6-inch thick book about Dirk Nowitzki, which is excellent. If I could bring the camera over, my shelf above my refrigerator is sinking down because of all the sports biographies and memoirs and stuff that I've been reading recently. But Friday Night Lights just off the top of my head. But I'm gonna kick myself after this call because there's the Kevin Garnett one was amazing. KG A to Z, it's called.
Right.
That was great too. I don't know. There's so many great ones, and I have a bunch on my shelf that I'm about to read, including the Mahmoud Abdul-Arouf.
Biography
that I want to read too.
Things
like that. So yeah, there's a ton of them, and I hope the genre continues to thrive.
Because
you learn so much. You know, there's the athlete's life, there's the story, but there's so many social dynamics. You know, webbed. You know, interconnected with these stories. That not only the history of the game and the coaches and the teammates, all that stuff, but just what life is like for people who become great and often, as is, you know, American history, come from dire situations. And so anyway, thank you for giving this a platform, Paul. And it's a pleasure to speak with you. And thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jake. And best of luck with the book.
Thank you.